Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Lob podcast from These Football Times. I'm Aidan Williams and it's magazine time again. And this time we're veering away from the club editions once more and focusing on one iconic player. Now in the past we've done Maradona, we've done Baggio, we've done Ronaldo, and now we've got another hugely iconic player to focus on. Footballers don't come much more iconic than Johan Cruyff, a revolutionary, visionary player, manager, idealist, inspiration, and all of it while looking damn cool as well. It will be out on the 1st of November, and as usual, it will sell out quickly, so don't leave it too long to get your order in. This one will be a perfect bit of reading to accompany the World Cup as well, of course, getting all nostalgic about 1974, with the mag probably due to land on doorsteps around the time the action in Qatar gets underway. So perfect. So before we get into all things Cruyff, though, let me introduce the gang who are here to chat about the great man, about the magazine and about their articles, of course. How could I not go to Gary first, though? He's dressed in orange with two stripes on the arm. So, Gary Thacker, how are you doing there?
I'm good, Aidan, thank you. And it's a chance to talk about probably, I mean, I've seen some great players play in my time, but this guy is right up there with them and probably the most influential footballer of all time, I would say. And this mag's been a long time coming, but it's great to get this one out there now. And there's some great articles in this, and I can't wait to get hold of my copy and read it because it's going to be fascinating, mate.
You're right. This is one we've mooted a few times, isn't it? So it's great we finally got there. It's got its turn. Also with us tonight, Paul McParlin. How are you doing there, Paul?
Yeah, still recovering from last night, as we spoke about, Aidan. But yeah, looking forward to this one. It's going to cheer me up and for the player like Johan Cruyff and Everton's team at the moment. I mean, that would absolutely transform your season, wouldn't it? But I mean, I think as Gary's indicated there, I mean, I think, you know, as anybody who you know, grew up watching Johan Cruyff, he was just an absolute icon of the game. I mean, that word is so overused these days, but he absolutely is. And of course, like a lot of those players who kind of made the name in the 60s and 70s, there's not a great deal of video footage of his earlier career. So, you know, it's not like, you know, there's probably more clips of like Astor Young on YouTube than what there is in Johan Cruyff, which is just totally bizarre, isn't it? So, and sometimes, you know, it's about going back and reading the reports about it and creating that picture in your own mind and own head of what an outstanding player he was. And unlike many outstanding players, he went on to be an outstanding manager as well. So, you know, if one person represents the vision of what the concept of total football was, I'm sure Gary would totally concern that man as a certain.
Would he have looked as cool if he was in Everton Blue, Paul?
Undoubtedly.
Alas, we will never know. We will never know. And finally, Stephen Scragg. How are you doing there, Steve?
Oh, doing well, Aidan. Looking forward to this. I mean, is there a more esoteric footballing, you know, messiah? Absolutely everything, you know, disco dancer, you know, the great thinker, you know, the mover, you know, he had all the answers, whether it was on the pitch or on the touchline or, you know, even in TV studio from time to time. You know, this is long overdue. And yeah, he's, you know, it is. It's about time.
It is about time. So, yes, without further ado then, Cruyff Magazine's got, well, a whole load of articles, as you'd expect, covering all of his career on and off the field, and a few extras too, all come with some stunning artwork, as you'd expect, of course. But the articles, then, just to go through what we've got before we start discussing them, we've got his rise and early career at Ajax. Now, Paul's written that one, and I'm sure we'll get into that. His time as a player at Barcelona. We've got an intriguing one from Gary about the memories of watching him live, so that'll be a fascinating one to chat about. We've got his US years, of course, and his time with his national team with the Netherlands. Gary back there again. His Eredivisie return, Stephen's written that one. And then we go into management, his time at Ajax. That's me. And then he moves on to Barcelona. And we've got articles about his legacy and also a piece of based around 14 quotes. So that'll be an interesting one to find out what those ones are, because, you know, if you Google Cruyff quotes, you get about 100 fabulous ones. So I don't know how we've got down to 14. But before we get into discussing those articles, let's just get some other first thoughts on Cruyff. We talk there about esoteric, inspirational, all these kind of words we've said about him. You know, what do you think, Gary, I'll come to you because you're the one who's seen him live. Is he someone who was he developed by the time he was in, do you think? You know, do you think that was critical to how he became as a player? Or do you think his kind of skills would have come to the fore regardless?
Such was his talent. And in so many ways, I think it would have happened anyway. But, you know, got put the mix, the sort of mixture in the bowl and stirred it nicely. And when he appeared at Ajax in the early 60s first and Dick Buckingham, who gave him his debut, and later under Mickles, he blossomed, and it was the perfect guy in the perfect place at the perfect time, and total football couldn't have been more suitable for this guy. As I say, you know, you've got great players, and when I was doing research for my article, he played less than 50 times for the Orange, less than 50 international games. He played in one World Cup, played in one European Championship, as the likes of Pelé, Maradona, Beckenbauer, who we would consider the great players, played in multiple tournaments. Yet this guy, as I said earlier, has probably had more influence on the future of football from his time as a player and as a coach than any other player in the history of the game. His legacy still lives on at Ajax. Pep Guardiola took his sort of teachings further on. I mean, it's just a guy who was immensely talented on the field. And it's this sort of contrast between being a wonderful player and not a very nice person in some people's eyes. But he had this belief in himself that what he was doing was right, not because he wanted to be right, just because he was born to be right. And so many times he proved that to be the case.
Yeah, what do you think, Stephen? Is that a Dutch characteristic, this utter certainty? It seems to be something that crops up more than once in great Dutch players, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think it's definitely something within the psyche of the Dutch. You know, I've worked with a Dutchman that has that streak in him. You know, I think it's a determination. You know, it's an admirable thing. You know, it can come across as being epically arrogant. You know, it can be dislikable on some levels. You know, in certain circumstances, but you know, it is. I don't know this. Magnificent drive, not to be competitive, but I don't know. I think it's just to whatever the sphere is, it's to do the very best that they can, you know, with the tools that are at their possession. It doesn't matter what it is, you know, whether that's football or whatever line of work it is or whatever task that they've taken on, you know, because you only have to look at. You know, David Winner's book's brilliant for this, for Brilliant Orange, and the way that Amsterdam as a city kind of like reclaims land from the sea. And, you know, it's all about the spatial awareness, and it's such a small landmass and having to make the most of it. You know, and this is where a lot of the deep-seated, you know, esoteric thinking comes from as a nation as a whole. And you've got to understand that this is where Cruyff has come from. You know, this post-war, you know, environment where, you know, there's a frugality and a need to be clever with thinking. And, you know, he's a product of his surroundings, of his era, of his upbringing, you know, the loss of his father as well early. But yeah, he is very much the pinnacle of Dutch society in so many ways. And but within that, he's reflective of the nation. And so many of the people that come from it.
Yeah,
just jump in there, briefly.
Yeah, sure.
When I was writing my book, The Beautiful Bridesmaid, Dressed in Orange book about the Dutch national team in the 70s, I had an interview with a guy called Jan Herman de Bruyne, who's quite a well-known Dutch journalist over there. And he told me there's only one thing more arrogant than a Dutchman, and that's a successful Dutchman. And Cruyff was the ultimate successful Dutchman, and you know, he had a massive, massive ego, but the ability to fulfill it as well.
Well, yeah, massive ego is one thing, but when you've got the ability to back it up, it kind of, you know, you let people away with it sometimes, don't you? But let's go to where it all began then, Paul, because you've been writing about his rise in Ajax. So a lot of what the guys are mentioning there about his environment and so on that he came through, I guess, was feeding into what you've done there. So the key role he obviously played in the development at Ajax in the 60s and early 70s before he disappeared off to pastures new. But you know, it's quite an impact he had from right from the start, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. I mean, I was trying to come to this from a different angle, really. So Stephen may appreciate this, but I took my starting point for the European Cup tie when Ajax played Liverpool. And I think you've got to put yourself in that time era. So, you know, it's December 1966, and Ajax were unheard of as a club in England, in the UK. You know, the only way you found out about international football in those days was either one, you bought World Soccer, which most people couldn't afford to buy, or two, you waited for Santa to bring you the international football book each year, which gave you an overall picture of what was going on across the European continent. So they were your only source of information. So at that time, the people going to the match really didn't know what to expect, because Holland as a football nation were nothing. You know, they weren't on the radar. Ajax's previous appearance in the European Cup, they'd been knocked out in 1961 by Fredrikstad, I think, from Norway. So there was no tradition there at all. I was having this discussion, you know, with my son. I got to read the article, and he goes, "So Ajax were never a big club originally." I said, "No, they only burst onto the scenes because of Johan Cruyff in the mid-60s. Before then, Dutch football generally and club football in Holland was nothing to write home about." So I went back to dig out. I've got that programme from the Liverpool Ajax game, the game at Anfield. And in those days, your main source of information about opposition players was the fabulous pen pictures, when the programme editor had to sum up a play in about four lines to try and give you a picture of what he's like. And this is what the quote is in Liverpool's programme for that game. "Johan Cruyff is one of the finest discoveries in Dutch football of recent years. Cruyff is the most talented, if sometimes impetuous, player, and at 19 has a great career in front of him. His ball control is amazing, and so is his dribbling." I have to say, for somebody to write that about Johan Cruyff in the photo at that time, that's his career, isn't it? I mean, that's such a succinct summary of what a talented player he was. And you know, he scored two goals at Anfield that night. I think the next person to do that was Frédéric Chasson for Sion in the 90s. That record held for about 30 years. It's an incredible European record, really. And to me, that was the breakthrough moment for Johan Cruyff, because I'd never heard him before then. I think most people in England never heard him before then. And I think Steve Copper wrote an article about having been at that game. He said, as he left the Kop that night, the question on everybody's list was, where'd he come from? Who's he? What's the background here? Because nobody really heard of him. So what was the background? So it kind of went back to where he started off from. And then, you know, he like lots of footballers, the post-Second World War generation, he grew up in a council estate. He grew up in a place called Bessendorf, which is like, it actually translated in Dutch as a concrete village. And the whole estate was actually made of concrete. So as a kid, he spent his time kicking the ball against curbs. And one thing he learned about concrete was, if someone knocks you and you fall over to the concrete, it hurts. So he then spent all his time practicing not being caught or tackled by opponents, because he was a pretty flimsy guy. I think he described himself as having a physique like a shrimp. And he really did not want to get injured or knocked about. So he perfected the technique of anticipating and avoiding those tackles. He was also, as far as he might still be today, the first footballer I know who was fascinated by the idea of the use of mathematics in football, the idea of solving problems, finding space, making calculations. In 1962, he had the opportunity of going to watch Real Madrid play in the European Cup final against Benfica, and he was selected to be a ball boy because apparently Ajax could choose ball boys for those occasions. And he was just fascinated by the maestro. Even though he was 35, he was just absolutely mesmerised by the way Di Stefano totally dominated the game. And there's almost like a vindication of how he saw football was going to be played. Now, I think it was touched upon before that, you know, as he was making his way in football, because he was spotted at the age of 10 by a coach at Ajax who lived on that estate. I'd watched him mesmerised playing football and thought, this guy doesn't even need a child. We're taking him on straight away. And things were going quite well there. But then I think, as Gavo Stephen mentioned before, his dad died suddenly at the age of 12. In fact, on the day his father died, Cruyff was at a leavers event at his school and got called out to go home to be greeted with his father, have a heart attack, and died that evening. So that had a massive, profound effect upon him. And we touched upon there about the idea of him being opinionated, self-confidence. There is a view that that's a reaction to losing his father at such an early age. The only way you could survive in a dressing room for alpha males was by being opinionated, by having your self-belief, by having your self-confidence. And without those qualities, he would have just been submerged by the culture of football. Although he had the footwork, though he had the skills, he didn't have the physique. So the coaches spent a lot of time building his physique up. Apparently, he used to practice and training. But one of the techniques he came up with was they got him to give players piggybacks across the training grounds. Each time, a player slightly more heavy than the next. So he progressed from carrying players who weighed 50 kilos to players who weighed 70, 80 kilos, building his strength gradually that way. And he was also talented at other sports. So he was also a very good baseball player. And he always, he recognises the deseos to baseball in terms of how it helped him with his ball control, anticipation, positional skills, all those sorts of things. In fact, he played the same baseball team as Johan Niskanen, who apparently, I hadn't realised, was so good at baseball, actually spent a summer with Chicago Cubs because they were so impressed by his talent in that sport. And amazing enough as well, Cruyff was also good at cricket. So he wasn't just a good footballer. He was also a genuine all-round sportsman. So you can see where the self-confidence comes from. You're good at any sport that you do. Obviously, that's going to give you a huge, huge reservoirs of self-belief. Obviously, money was an issue for the Cruyff family after his father died. Unfortunately, Ajax, the club, helped out by the manager, Vic Buckingham, employing Cruyff's mum as a housekeeper. It also meant that Buckingham almost became like a father figure to the young Cruyff as well, and also gave Cruyff the opportunity to practice his English, because he was never greatly motivated by education. But chatting to Buckingham's teenage sons also gave him a chance to better practice his English, which came in quite useful for him in later life. Buckingham wasn't doing too well in the 64-65 season, so he tried Cruyff out in a friendly game away at Helmandia 55. And he scored in the 87th minute. Now, he's only 17 at the time, but he did enough there to earn a first-team debut away against GVAV of Groningen, scored in that game as well. And made quite a favourable impression. But one or two games later, they got thrashed 9-4 by Feyenoord, and that kind of had two consequences, really. One, Cruyff himself found himself out of the team. And two, Buckingham was relieved of his post. And those two, Buckingham leaving, and then Ajax appointed one of their former players, Reinders Michels, and then what he did for Johan Cruyff, arguably made Cruyff the player he became, because Vic Buckingham had quite a lax laissez-faire regime. He more believed in kind of a benign regime rather than laying down the law. Reinders Michels was quite the opposite, and he was on a Cruyff all the time, fining him for being late in training, fining him for his attitude, and Cruyff, being an addicted smoker almost, was constantly getting fined for sneaking off for cigarettes before training, after training. But although Cruyff rebelled, which is kind of in the Dutch nature we touched upon before, eventually he grew to realise that his game was actually starting to improve under the new manager. And so from that moment onwards, his career kind of really kicked off. Now, Reinders Michels only picked Cruyff for five of the first 12 games he was in charge, 64-65. The following season, he didn't actually start many of the games until an injury to Nunninga. And then once he got into the team, there's no stopping him. Ajax won the league that season. Considering he finished 13th the season before, that was some turnaround. Cruyff got 23 out of 25 goals. And basically, his career was on the rise then as well. Gary touched upon before the lack of international caps. And one of the things that kind of didn't get his international career off to the best start was that on his second game for the Netherlands, he got sent off playing against Czechoslovakia and ended up getting a 1 year's ban by the Dutch FA, which finally got reduced to 10 months. Despite him showing video evidence in his favour, despite written match reports, the Dutch FA says something like, we can't prove that you hit the referee as you've been accused of, but either way, we consider your conduct to be unsporting. And that was the basis on which he was banned for 10 months, which just seems absolutely ludicrous and incredible. So Ajax getting their first European Cup, 66-67 version. And then, they come through against Besiktas in the first round, and then they draw Liverpool. Now, this game's quite famous, in terms of the history of European football, because I think you never quite know which of those Shankly's quotes to believe, because there are so many being regurgitated. Some you think are facts, some are fiction. You just don't know. But allegedly, and Cruyff mentions this in his book, that he reckoned the players have been quite wound up by the fact that Shankly said, who are Ajax? I've never heard of Ajax. And then in the game, Ajax absolutely destroyed them 5-1, Cruyff scoring one of the goals as well. And Cruyff orchestrated the whole match from start to finish. Liverpool, and not just Liverpool, any team couldn't have dealt with them on that night. The match was played in foggy conditions, so at the end of the game, Shankly apparently said, well, the Dutch are used to playing in fog. It would be different when we get them back to Anfield. And if that's a true statement, and I don't know if it is, that was just bizarre because, clubs on Merseyside quite often played in Pea Supers in the mid-60s. It was not unusual for one end of the ground to be chatting to the other who scored the goal and the other end chatting back who it was. So that seemed quite a flimsy excuse anyway. And I think that made Cruyff in particular determined that once he got to Anfield, he was going to show the English public what he was capable of. He scored two goals in the game, as I said. And the next day, the English press was just full of praise, plaudit, admiration, adulation for this absolute genius of a footballer who was still only 19, who had just turned on an absolute superlative display of football. And I think, to me, that was the game when Johan Cruyff became a major football international star. That game put Ajax on the map. That game put the Netherlands on the map. That game established that there was a new style of football being played. It was coming from a country that had no tradition of success in football, a country that never even qualified for a World Cup or a European Championship until 1974. And it was just, it was the game that put Cruyff on the map. And although before the match, people were saying, who's this Cruyff fella? After that game, everybody knew who he was. So yeah, it's just a fascinating story of how he managed to create that impression and leave a lasting legacy on. I mean, obviously, there will still be people alive today who would have to, I don't know whether your father was there or not, Stephen.
Yeah, he was there. And it was a bit of a foggy night at Anfield for the second leg as well. So it was just the same at Anfield as it had been in Amsterdam.
Well, yes. Doing well against Liverpool is clearly the path to stardom there, Stephen, isn't it?
Well, the amazing thing about those games is that when Buckingham first went to Ajax in 59, because he did 59 to 61 and then went back again in 64, was that it was essentially a part-time game. It wasn't, it wasn't the professional game at all. Buckingham cites kind of like the players that he inherited had all the abilities, and all the technical know-how. Jack Reynolds had laid so many of the scriptures down at Ajax, many years before. And he was quite, so Buckingham was quite taken aback by just how, skilled the players were, how it's all very well in one-touch football and the passing. He said all he had to do really was to tell them to utilise possession, to protect the ball, to, enjoy possession of the ball and to just to drill them and say just how important it is to keep hold of the ball. He said apart from that, the job was a doddle for him, certainly that first time around. But, it was still undeniably a part-time game. And Cruyff comes into a very dysfunctional side. That 64-65 season, it's not going particularly well for Buckingham, and then Fulham come knocking and he's happy to jump back to England. But within that second half of that season when Meikles is in charge, the results are worse than they are in the first half of the season. And relegation's a very real possibility. So to turn that around from this basket case of a season to win the Eredivisie the following season, and then you're going into kind of like European Cup, and you're knocking out Liverpool. Now, this is a Liverpool side that had reached the 1966 Cup Winners' Cup final, losing it on rainy night at Hampden Park against Borussia Dortmund. The previous season to that, they'd reached the European Cup semi-finals and gone out in, shall we say, contentious circumstances against Inter Arsenal in the semi-final. So Liverpool had only two seasons of European football, but two very significant seasons of European football. So for Ajax to be kind of like taking on this side that had reached a major European final, reached a European Cup semi-final, and not just kind of like taking them on, but absolutely turning them apart and giving them a footballing lesson, was incredible stuff. And Cruyff was, you know, at the centre of it all as a teenager. This link between him and Michels and this symbiosis between the two had already, you know, taken hold at Ajax.
Gary, you've written a book on this this time period, haven't you, in Ajax? So, you know, you'll have some thoughts here, I'm quite sure, on Cruyff and the role he played in what Ajax became after he'd gone in some part, but, you know, the rise that he was part of alongside Michels, as Stephen says there.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating hearing the guys talk about this sort of period, because as you mentioned, I've got my book coming out. It's called The Dutch Masters, which is about Ajax rise through the 60s and the sort of domination of European football in the early 70s. And Cruyff obviously was the key element of this. And the game that the guys have been mentioned about, the Liverpool game, there's a great recording on YouTube of this, and BBC, I think it was a BBC commentator, his name escapes me now, and he's absolutely aghast that Liverpool are conceded 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 goals. And each time you say, this can't be happening, this is crazy, this can't be happening, it's actually sort of the shock of the reality of what's happening in front of him. And I think it's Chris Lawler scored a late goal to get 5-1. And then in the return, I think Roger Hunt scored 2 and Cruyff scored 2 to just to sort of round it off. But it was a sort of statement of... not of intent, a statement of arrival of Ajax and their title football. And Cruyff very much was the vanguard of Michels's revolution at Ajax that had been started by Buckingham to some extent. But Cruyff, in his autobiography, says that although he and I think it was a guy called Keith Spurgeon afterwards who took over when Buckingham left, but Michels's arrival was when it really took off. And, if Buckingham was being the sort of guy who taught Cruyff how to read and write, the university education was from Michels, and Cruyff blossomed from there. And you know, as history sort of states, you know, they become a wonderful football club and totally revolutionised the way the game was played in not only in the Dutch league but also across Europe and indeed across the globe as well. And very much of that was down to Cruyff. And a massive part of the book I've got coming out covers this, and I was fortunate to have get an interview with Ruud Krol, who came through a little bit later, and then Johnny Rep, who was even later, and they sort of speak in glowing terms of Cruyff and his influence at Ajax and how important he was to the development of the club there.
But then, of course, he moved to Spain, to Barcelona, and had a big influence over there as well, didn't he? Now, he followed... Michels went a year before him, I think, and he left to join him in 73. Echoes of what might happen later on when he leaves Ajax again. Little fallings out and arguments and things like that, but you would expect nothing less. So, obviously, yes, he flourished in Barcelona as well. But yeah, this is going to be the Gary show for a little bit now, because the next couple of articles, are ones that you can talk about as well, because, you know, there is a piece on his time at Barcelona specifically, of course. But as you said earlier, you've written a piece about seeing him play, and that was for Barcelona. So this is an intriguing one. I think it's going to be a fascinating angle. I mean, rather than simply telling us what you've written, because, you know, we can read that as like, well, how did this idea form and how did you sort of shape this one?
Well, by the time Cruyff came to play against, he's played for Barcelona, as you said, I think it was a UEFA Cup game against Aston Villa. This is in 1977. He'd been at Barcelona for a while, Cruyff. Michels left after the Cup triumph, the European Cup triumph in 73. He'd already signed the agreement, but none of the players knew. I've bent the head from Ruud Krol when I was speaking to him. But he left, and then Cruyff left after the third victory in 73. So he's getting towards the end of his time at Barcelona, but I'm a massive fan of Dutch football and Ajax. and the Dutch team, the international Dutch team, 74, 76 European Championship. And when they got Barcelona drawn to play at Aston Villa, I used to live in Warsaw at the time, so just north of Birmingham. I mean, I couldn't not go, you know. And it's people say, you know, there's very few things in the world where you go to travel that you're not disappointed by. The Grand Canyon is one. Cruyff is the other. And it was an October or November time. It was wet, typical Birmingham night. I had to walk, catch a bus into Warsaw, catch a train from Warsaw to Birmingham. Then walked a fair jaunt from the railway station to Villa Park to watching. It was worth every step. That's how the pitch was terrible. But some players have this ability to play on any surface. And I'm still not sure, as I look back, that his feet actually touched the ground. He's sort of like a will-o'-the-wisp hovering over it, where other players were plodding through a treacle. This guy was sort of on skates, and it was a wonderful performance. And it wasn't at his best. He was sort of, he came towards the end, probably 15 minutes from the end, and he scored a wonderful goal. He scored a wonderful goal for Barca. They were 2-0 up, and until very late, and they got two late goals. And I remember standing up and thinking, this is wonderful. This is what football is. And, you know, I mean, all the Villa fans, in fairness, around me sort of, you know, were applauding as well, because this was, it was majesty. It was wonderful. It was one of the great things of our time. If you're a football fan, you know, you have to appreciate great talent. And it was a wonderful evening. It was cold, it was wet, but it's lodged in my memory forever. And I use it as the introduction for my first book on Dutch football, The Beautiful Prize, Manchester in Orange. And because, as I say, it was one of those things where no matter how good you expect it to be, it lived up to the expectation. Cruyff as a footballer. As I say, I've seen great players. I've seen Ronaldo. I've seen Messi many times. I've seen Ronaldinho. I never saw Pelé play. I saw Maradona. I saw Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, name what you like. I've seen Zidane play. I've seen George Best play. Cruyff. Different class. I'm sorry, just different class.
Well, there you go, Paul. Anyone had similar impact on you with seeing them? You've seen the 66 World Cup at Goodison, I'm guessing. So maybe you can fill in the blank that Gary didn't get there of seeing Pelé.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think we talked about the 66 World Cup extension on a podcast a couple of years ago. But yeah, I mean, I saw the first game at Goodison when Brazil beat Bulgaria 2-0. Pelé scored from free kick. It was just fantastic. You can't buy that sort of experience. You really can't. You can't put a price on it. And then sadly, you know, he got injured in that game. And then when he came back for the Portugal game, so we talked about this before, he was just actually kicked out of the competition. It was an absolute travesty and a disgrace what happens, and the total lack of protection from referees. So, yeah, but I can say I've seen Pelé. I know, as Gary's referenced there are some players you see and you'll go to your grave happy that you can say, yeah, I was there. I saw them play. I was only 10, but I've seen Pelé play at Goodison Park in the World Cup. No, I'm happy that'll do me. And in terms of Johan Cruyff, I'll just say two things to time with what Gary said there as well. I've seen Cruyff once at Anfield of all places, because there's I think in April 76. This is going to sound really sad, this, I appreciate that, but in the afternoon, I went to see Everton reserves play a Central League game. Forget who against, and then I went straight from that game across to Anfield.
You know exactly who it was, Paul. You've got the programme in your loft. I know you have.
I probably have, sadly. And I went across to Anfield in the days when you could just pay at the gate for the European game. You could just turn up, pay your cash on the turnstile, and walk in. I think the score was 1-1. And I think, like Gary indicates there, it wasn't peak Cruyff. You know, he was 29. He wasn't a player he'd been a couple of years before. Barcelona weren't the team they'd been a couple of years before. But, you know, hey, I watched him. And at times, you know, he just oozes effortless grace, control, mastery of the ball that, compared to the Everton reserve game, you just saw the absolute difference in class from an absolute artist at work. But this isn't particularly seen him live, but I was in my first year in Leeds in 1974, and in the halls of residence, we had one black and white TV, and we were engrossed by the World Cup, and Holland, everyone just loved Holland. And my overriding memory is that semi-final against Brazil, when Brazil were trying to kick Holland off the park. And when Johan Cruyff scored the second goal, I've never known a noise like it watching our football game. The next day, having our breakfast in the dining, again, a couple of the girls come and say, what the hell was going on last night? What was all the noise? What was all the shouting about? And it was just the sheer joy and ecstasy of football being the victor. Because so many times in the 60s and 70s, football was not the victor. But on this occasion, the sheer class of Johan Cruyff and Neeskens combined, but Cruyff in particular, just made that match just a wonderful, wonderful experience to watch. And I think, you know, as Gary's touched upon there, it's sometimes certain players, certain matches just leave that everlasting imprint on your life. And, you know, we'd never seen the likes of Cruyff before. I'd argue we're never going to see the likes of Cruyff again.
Well, there's a tagline for the magazine if ever I heard one. Cruyff, better than Everton reserves. How about that? I feel a bit left out here because two of you said you've seen Cruyff play. So, Stephen, if you're going to tell me you've seen him play, I'm going to feel really, really sorry with my lot.
No, he was beyond me. I never got the chance to see him. You know,
Who had a similar impact on you, though? Right, someone you've seen, you know, first time you saw Dalgleish or something like that?
Yeah, I think for... It's going to sound really awful, but you take your own for granted. You know, it's when you see someone else in an opposing shirt, you know, it's somewhat different. You know, there's something. Again, it's that era when, you know, it's not the internet, it's not satellite television, sports channels. It's, you know, these are snapshot images that you see of players. But yeah, for me, 81, you know, would have been, I don't know, seeing Breitner, you know, playing for Bayern Munich at Anfield, the European Cup semi-final. You know, it's that type of, you know, impression that you take from these games. It's the, you know, I've seen Lionel Messi play and all those, but because they come along in an era where it's saturation and you see them every week, it doesn't have that same imprint. It doesn't have that. It's just not there. But yeah, you know, I think with Cruyff, I remember the tale. The only thing I can describe it to is, it's like, you know, I'm a child of the 70s and early 80s. So I remember kind of like Muhammad Ali, you know, the very tail end of his career. And I remember him losing to Trevor Burbick. I remember him losing to Larry Holmes. You know, I remember the tail end of Cruyff. I remember him being an Ajax player the second time around because that penalty, you know, was just shown repetitively on World of Sports and Grandstand, Football Focus, and on the ball. So you know, and everyone knew who Cruyff was. You know, you couldn't, you know, he might have been beyond my era as such. You know, his peak years were beyond my era, but you knew exactly who he was. You know, you were told about these players. You know, you were. You know, for me, you know, these are players that you grew up listening to stories about, and then you'd see these images of him as an older player that would crop up sometimes on, you know, like say Football Focus or whatever. But yeah, you know, he just an absolute god of the game, and yeah, of all the players that I never got to see, you know, he's the one that I would choose to go back and see. Given the chance.
Yes, we just need a time machine of some sort, don't we? We
can
sort all things out.
Indeed.
We might change the odd result here and there as well. You never know. Well, speaking of wanting to change the odd result, Gary, we'll come back to you. We'll go all orange now. Yeah. So your second piece in the magazine, of course, is about his time with the national team. You've already said he didn't play with them as many times as you might imagine or as he might have done for various reasons. Go for it then. Tell us all about this, what you've done here. And I don't think we need to work out what piqued your interest about this one in particular.
Well, I mean, you might have to stop me in about 45 minutes if I'm still going, because, I mean, wearing the Alanya shirt is there's so many stories. I mean, as Paul mentioned, he got his debut, it was September 66, and he scored his debut. And playing under an Austrian guy called Kessler, who was coaching the Arnie at the time. And the second game, he came back and got sent off, and as Paul quite rightly pointed out, got banned by the KNVB. That was the start of a, I would never say a love-hate relationship, but a hate-hate relationship between the KNVB and Cruyff. Both needed each other, but both disliked each other immensely. And you know, at the time when Cruyff started playing international football, there's a famous line, Stephen mentioned David would be coming. I have a simple conversation with David, and he was very kind enough to give me an interview for my the Ags book I've got coming out next year. And there's a phrase he uses in Brilliant Orange that when Cruyff started playing international football, the Dutch had an international record on a par with that of Luxembourg. They qualified, they played in the 1934 World Cup, played once, lost. Played in the 1938 World Cup, played once and lost. And didn't qualify again for another World Cup until 1974. They didn't qualify for any European Championships before 1974. That was a standard of Dutch football, international football at the time. The guy I mentioned earlier about when Ajax were a sort of part-time team, I think I've got this right. I think Piet Keizer was the first player to be given a professional contract by Ajax, and Cruyff was the second one. It might be the way around, but I think that's correct. But this was the standard of Dutch football at the time, and how things changed when Cruyff arrived in the international scene. And Kessler was replaced by a guy called Verdonk, who was a born but nationalised Dutch guy who took over the team and eventually got them qualified for the 1974 World Cup. Although it was a sort of, shall we say, controversial qualification, because in the last game, they played Belgium at home and a draw would have got them through. Belgium needed to win. And in the last couple of minutes, a free kick was played into the Dutch box by the Belgian captain, whose name escapes me at the moment, and he was put in the back of the net. And basically, the linesman, who was a Russian at the time, flagged offside. The replay suggests there were at least three Dutch players playing this guy, playing him onside. And if that goal had been disallowed, the history of football would be so very different. But basically, the goal was disallowed, and Cruyff and the Dutch went to the 1974 World Cup. Strange, the team that had, a record similar to that of Luxembourg, as favourites, as one of the favourites to win the tournament, because this was on the back of the success of Feyenoord in 1970 winning the European Cup, and then Ajax in 71, 72, 73 winning the European Cup. And the sort of preparations for the tournament just showed how the massive influence Cruyff had. And there's 17,000 stories that I'm only going to pick one or two. The famous story of the stripes on the shirt, as you mentioned, Aidan, earlier. My shirt I'm wearing now has had two stripes. The Dutch had signed, the KNVB signed a deal with Adidas to sponsor their shirts, to provide the shirts. It was the first time that had a sort of even remotely like that sort of contract agreed. And part of the deal was that the shirt Adidas provided would have three stripes on. Well, Cruyff had signed a contract with Puma. It was the brother of Adidasler. It was the guy on Puma was the brother of Adidasler at Adidas. And the sort of rivalry between the two was somewhat fraught, shall we say. And Cruyff said, I can't play in this shirt. And eventually they came to an agreement where Cruyff was allowed to wear a shirt with two stripes on the sleeve rather than three. Another situation was right with Jan van Beveren, who was probably the outstanding Dutch goalkeeper at the time, one of the outstanding goalkeepers in Europe. And he sort of fell out with Mikkels, and he'd been injured, and Mikkels went to play in a friendly game, and he didn't want to play because he didn't want to risk injury and such. Like, anyway, basically Mikkels sort of said, well, okay, you can't go. And the discussion was who was going to replace Van Beveren. And Piet Schrijvers was the obvious choice, who played in the Dutch national team before the tournament because of Van Beveren's absence through injury. But apparently under Cruyff's prompting, Mikkels selected a guy who hadn't played international football for 12 years, had one previous cap, which basically encompassed 5 minutes as a substitute 12 years previously, in which he conceded a goal. And Jan Youngblood was the guy who was playing for FC Amsterdam at the time. And the logic was that Youngblood was better with his feet than the other goalkeeper options. Peter Graflander was playing for Feyenoord, and Shrivers. And strange thing was, and I've watched these games throughout the tournament many times, on only one occasion in that tournament was Jean-Claude required to play with his feet. And when his overhead pass came through, he scampered out of his area. Instead, and he didn't actually collect the ball, lay it off to Kroll or Serbia or Hahn. He hoofed the ball up the park like, you know, any self-respecting Division 3 footballer would have done the same. So, I mean, it seemed a strange situation, and it was also arguments about money and the shirts. And Cruyff said, you know, to Kane and VB, said, it's our shirt, we'll do what we want. And Cruyff said, it might be your shirt, but it's my head coming through the shirt that makes it valuable. So many things. And then, of course, the tournament started, and Cruyff was probably the best player in the, well, I say probably, I mean, I'd argue anybody with him, he wasn't the best player in the entire tournament. Of course, some wonderful goals. I mean, Paul mentioned earlier about the goal against Brazil. Beauty slaying the beast, wonderful moments. But probably the best goal of the tournament for me was the one against Argentina. The Paletti poise, the balance, just the grace, the elegance, picking the ball out to the air, Van Hanegem, chipped his ball, pulled it down, coaxed him to spill, easy past the goalkeeper, avoiding the sort of trailing foot was meant to pull it down and roll into the onion bag. I mean, wonderful, wonderful. And of course, 74, we get to the final. And, you know, the first time the Germans touched the ball was when they fetched it out in the onion bag. Cruyff had set up the goal running from... When he received the ball inside the first, I don't know, 30 seconds of the game, there's only one Dutch player behind him, and that was the goalkeeper. Bertie Vogts has been appointed to mark Cruyff. It's like, you know, I mean, it's like trying to trap a light in a box. I mean, how do you do that? And Cruyff sort of, and he had this wonderful ability, and he wasn't a great dribble of the ball. He almost swayed past players. The only other player I've seen in recent times do it is probably Michael Laudrup, who had a similar sort of style. Not a great sort of three sort of step overs and that sort of thing, but just sort of swayed elegantly like water. You can't control water. It's going to find a way past you, and that's what he did. And he was brought down on the edge of the area, and on the area by, I think it was Olli Hernes. And Niskanen's put the ball in the back of the net, and he was 1-0. And it was, for the next 20 minutes or so, the Dutch played probably the best football in a World Cup final that, you know, has probably ever been seen. I mean, I used a quote in the book I wrote about the beautiful bridesmaids that from Ozymandias, the book Ozymandias. Look upon my work, you mighty, and despair. Because they were just brilliant. And then eventually they lost their way, and they lost the game, and they just became the beautiful losers. And 2 years afterwards, they got to the European Championship, qualified for the first time again for a major tournament, European Championship this time, and then lost a crazy game against Czechoslovakia on a windswept, rainy night when Clive Thomas decided he wanted to make himself the star of the game. And then a couple of years afterwards, 78, he qualified the Dutch and then couldn't go. Decided not to go because his family had been victim of a kidnap attempt in Barcelona. It just seems that the international career of Johan Cruyff was blighted by massive, well, sort of highlighted by massive highs and blighted by lows and strange things that happened that shouldn't have happened. And as I say, he played less than 50 games for the Dutch national team. And whereas, you know, Beckenbauer, Maradona, Pelé played, I don't know, 100 or so, played in several World Cups. Cruyff only played in one World Cup. He played one game in the European Championship finals. And yet his influence on international football was probably greater than any of those guys.
Oh, there we go.
I stopped quite early, Ben. I sort of catarred myself. There, you know?
I was ready with the mute button to stop you. okay, then, Stephen, on that theme, of what Gary's mentioning at the end there, talking about the influence he had. Now, this is obviously in a shorter space of time, so maybe this is how to phrase it. I'm just thinking it through my head of the question of like focusing probably on 74 in terms of the influence he had. Do you think the influence he had on that Dutch side as a player was stronger or deeper perhaps than the influence he had over slightly longer term as a player at Ajax and Barcelona?
Yes, I think it probably is. It's marginal between the Netherlands and Ajax. You know, there's so many of his teammates, you know, translated to that Netherlands side. Barcelona, you know, had a lot of talented domestic players, but he was the one star. You know, he was the dictator on the pitch, basically. You know, ironically, I suppose. I don't know. Again, it just comes to that symbiosis with his relationship with Michels. You know, it was there with Ajax, it was there with the Netherlands, and it was there with Barcelona for a while as well. You know, and it's I find it interesting is that by the time he gets to the 1974 World Cup, the best of his, I don't know, the best of his winning days have finished. You know, it's kind of over. It's bizarre to say it, and I go into a bit in my article is that between winning the La Liga title in 74 with Barcelona and winning the Eredivisie with Ajax again in 83, you know, a 9-year span. The only winner's medal he picks up between that period of time is a Copa del Rey winner's medal in 78. Because is Barcelona, after this epic first season he has with them, they underachieved greatly. You know, it's you know, stunning just how much they underachieve. There's a you know the lost UEFA Cup semi-final that Paul goes to at Anfield, but the year before they'd lost to Leeds United in the European Cup semi-final. So, you know, yes, it's that influence on that Ajax side and the Netherlands. I think with Ajax it's different because it's all the achievements with Ajax. Yet with the Netherlands it's unrealized. You know, he never picks up the trophy with the Netherlands that he does with Ajax. But within that it makes what he did with the Netherlands that little bit more ethereal. You know, it's like the Netherlands, it's like Hungary in 1954, it's like, you know, Brazil in 1982. You know, there's always going to be that mystique about that team that never quite won. And someone really needs to write a book. They're going to expose these sides. So, yeah.
Oh, if only.
I bet we Cruyff at the, with the Dutch national team, you know, I mean, this, as Stevie quite rightly says, so many players came through from the Ajax team and even from Feyenoord as well. I mean, Van Hanegem, Janssen, Rinus Israel came through from the Feyenoord team as well. But you know, if you're going to say, you know, who made the difference from the Dutch national team being akin to Luxembourg to being a team that went on to win to reach two successive World Cup finals. You know, Cruyff might not have been the main one, but he was in the top one.
Oh, if only he'd been born in Luxembourg, eh? This could have all been very, very different. But on this theme of influence, Paul, Cruyff once said, maybe we were the real winners in 1974. The world remembers our team more. Was he right?
Well, I think that's inspiration for your Google, wasn't it, Aidan?
Well, I think he's right.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's two ways of looking at this. I mean, there is this British natural empathy for, you know, the glorious losers, the ones who play with style and panache but don't quite win it. I think we've always been like that in terms of our football. And I think if you ask most people who saw the 1974 World Cup, the memories aren't of West Germany. The memories aren't of Franz Beckenbauer. The memories are of Holland, Neeskens, Cruyff, and that style of football. And I think in terms of total football, that was probably the first time a mass UK audience got to see it operating at the level which it was intended to operate. You might see snippets before that from European games, highlights, stuff like that. But yeah, there's definitely something about, you know, the losing in such style, similar to, I mean, Stu was here, be raving about Brazil in 82. There is something about losing in style. It goes back to Danny Blind's flower quote, doesn't it? The game is about glory. It's not always about winning. It's about glory. You know, we've all grown up watching teams who clawed their way to victories. You know, George Graham's Arsenal, teams like this, whose style of football would never enthrall you. But there's something about, you know, that Holland team, you know, in 74, you know, it was... When you just think of the quality of the interchange, of the passing, of the movement, you're watching, you know, in English football in the 70s, you weren't used to central defenders being so good on the ball. Your typical central defender was get the ball, kick it 60 yards forwards, job done, and spend the rest of the time kicking the opposition striker. The control of the Dutch, the poise of the Dutch, the balance, and the effortless grace which the interchange positions was just absolutely, you know, fascinating to behold. So yeah, there's a definite argument that, you know, Holland, they weren't the winners that are inscribed on the Jules Rimet Trophy, but on everyone's mind who witnessed that World Cup, Holland were the winning side.
Absolutely.
Can I just add in there for a second, if I can? There's a famous book that was written by a guy called Walker Cock, a Dutch journalist who also gave me an interview for my book coming out soon. It came out, I think, in 77. And it's called 1974, We Were the Best. And the Dutch had carried this sort of burden of being the team that should have won, that never won, and sort of the Germans had cheated them. This famous sort of instance, and the guy, his name escapes me, the winger who died for the penalty that Brighton converted for the equaliser. Somebody tell me his name. Come back in a second. Anyway, it doesn't matter. Come back. But there's a German word, and it's called Schwalbe, which actually translates literally as swallow, but it means like a swallow dive. And it's been sort of adopted into the Dutch language to mean anything that's a little bit like sharp practice in football. And the dive that sort of got the penalty, that got the Germans back into the game, has sort of became a haunted phrase for the Dutch. And the book, Orcock's book, it's a wonderful read. Sort of lances the boil and allows the Dutch to sort of move on from the issues that Paul accurately described there as being the team that everybody suddenly just sort of understood as being the beautiful losers, the beautiful bridesmaids.
If only VAR had been available in 1974, the whole course of
history. And Jensen, the guy, the final player who's apparently brought him down, doesn't touch him. He just doesn't touch him. Jack Taylor, actually, who was refereeing the English guy later, reviewing the tag, this had been a few years afterwards, said, yeah, I probably made a mistake with that.
It was Wim Jansen on Holstenbein, I think.
Holstenbein, that's the guy.
Yeah, it was Wim Jansen's leg that was in the vicinity, but not touching. Yeah, anyway, let's get away from the... We'll get stuck on this topic forever because it's something we can all talk about. vast length. Let's move back to the mundane club things, or not mundane when Cruyff's around. Stephen, you focused on his return to the Netherlands as a player after his little American adventure. He came back to Ajax and then to Feyenoord briefly, of course, winning plenty more as he did so. What piqued your interest on this topic in particular? Was it that penalty with Jesper Olsen?
Well, that's the one. That's always the reset image, isn't it? But I'd written a few years ago about his year at Feyenoord, and I was always fascinated by it because it's just so jarring seeing the images of Cruyff in a Feyenoord shirt. It's a bit like seeing images of Beckenbauer in a Hamburg shirt, you know, towards the tail end of his career. There's just some, you know, images that really scatter the brain somewhat, and this was one of them for me. And I was always fascinated by that year at Feyenoord. So to revisit that was always going to be a win for me. But it was the return to Ajax as well, because, you know, that image of him with that penalty with Jesper Olsen, it's so hard to eradicate from, you know, consciousness that, you know, what else was going on behind that. And, you know, to be able to look into that year and a half that he had back at Ajax. And again, it's, you know, typically to my articles, I stretch them a little bit further than the remit is yeah.
We would expect nothing out of it.
But, you know, it's one of these stories that kind of, it starts with kind of like 78 and his early retirement, you know, his initial retirement from football in 78. As a 31-year-old, he walks away from football and has every intention of staying away from football. And Barcelona give him a testimonial, a farewell game. And it's Ajax who are invited to come and play this game at the Camp Nou. And they are without their star players because they've been called up for the World Cup, because this game is taking place just days before the World Cup starts. So his best, you know, Barcelona teammates have been called up for Spain. Is, you know, the finest Ajax players. There's only three that go to Argentina, but all the same, you know, they head to Argentina as well. So it's a game that's kind of like, you know, it's all right, but, you know, it's not the send-off that he really deserves. Ajax, in turn, decide to give him this, you know, is their own send-off game in Amsterdam. Last time to pull on an Ajax shirt, and the invite Bayern Munich, who promptly go and stuff them 8-0 at the Olympic Stadium in Amsterdam, because they, you know, just because, you know, the Bayern Munich, and, you know, for whatever, there's a myriad of reasons why, you know, it's been floated over the years. It's been frustration from being pasted in European Cup games in the mid-1970s. It's, you know, there's always been talk about the Bayern players being annoyed by the accommodation they were given, you know, being chanted about, being accused of being Nazis by kind of like, you know, Ajax supporters as the coaches are going along. All sorts of reasons given why Bayern did what they did. But whereas Ajax went into that game with, you know, very much in the mind of it being a testimonial, you know, it should end up 7-7 and Cruyff winning, you know, scoring a symbolic penalty to finish it. This wasn't the way it went. You know, Bayern absolutely just went for it against a bemused Ajax. And in a way, it left this unfinished business. You know, how can you say that's the last of Cruyff and Ajax, this 8-0? So I think it's an itch, you know, that still needs scratching. So when Cruyff comes back into football, you know, he tries to be a businessman. That you know, he can't translate his genius from the football pitch into the boardroom. So, you know, he comes back to football. He does his ASL years, you know, and during down the downtime of the NASL season in 1980-81, he's invited to train with Ajax, and, you know, he ends up kind of like giving his input to a youngish Leo Beenhakker, who's the coach, and, you know, there's bad results, but then, you know, he helps turn them around, and they, you know, they finish the season strongly. But it plants this seed that when, you know, everything goes west in Washington, you know, they, as a franchise, the diplomats fold, and it opens the door for the opportunity to go back to Amsterdam. And, you know, he scores on his debut, this wonderfully, you know, esoteric goal, winds his way past three defenders, lobs the goalkeeper. And from there, it's just pure Cruyff. And, you know, a year and a half of helping, you know, the blossoming of the likes of Rijkaard, Vandenberg, and a very young Marco van Basten, all the Danish players that are, you know, part of that era of Ajax as well. And he wins the title, wins the double with them. But at 35, you know, Ajax hierarchy don't want to pay him as a player and as a, you know, to be on the coaching staff as well. They advise that he hangs up his boots. He doesn't see it that way. Takes himself off to Rotterdam, where he promptly wins the double with the arch rivals. He's voted Player of the Year by the journalists of the Netherlands, playing in the side with a young Rud Hullet, who wins Player of the Year as far as the players are concerned. Wins the cup double. It's just and again, it's this avalanche of success that he helps these two sides to. Like I say, he'd had that 9-year span where there'd been very little success in terms of winners' medals. You know, he falls narrowly short in the NASL with the Aztecs in LA and the diplomats in Washington. You know, he wins the personal accolades, but there's no trophy. It's almost like he's, I don't know, it's a penance to play for all this earlier success that he's had at Ajax. You know, to go and lose the World Cup with the Netherlands, then there's just this, I don't know, this domino effect of kind of like being in the constant bridesmaid all of a sudden, you know, because he loses the European Cup semi-final in 75, UEFA Cup semi-final in 76, the European Championships in 76. It's one after another. Even when he wins this Copa del Rey with Barcelona in 78 as a farewell, without him, Barcelona win the Cup Winners' Cup the following season. You know, that he'd have been part of it, had he given them one more season. You know, I think there's this, I don't know, this incurable itch, and there's a will to have to go back and, I don't know, right the wrongs of his farewells with Ajax. Because even the first round time around with Ajax, when he walks away, there's a heavy degree of rancor about it. You know, he's fallen out with squad members. You know, he's been voted out of the captaincy. You know, he leaves under a cloud. And, you know, so even in going back as coach to Ajax, you know, there's always this, I don't know, dysfunctional yet functional relationship that he has with the club. And you know, his playing days should have ended with them, but you know, that wasn't his fault. That was the hierarchy. That was the board members at Ajax that he felt drove him to. Into the loving embrace, well, not the loving embrace, the sceptical embrace of Feyenoord to begin with. But by the end of that season and what he does with them in 83-84, you know, changes completely. And it's the fascination in just what he does with them, because, you know, he pulls a lot of the technical strings in both of the successes of Ajax and Feyenoord in those years as well. It's the really kind of left field, you know, occurrences. It's Leo van Veen being brought in as a 36-year-old at Cruyff's behest from Utrecht, you know, a prolific striker, occasional playmaking midfielder, never quite good enough to make the national squad, but he played with Cruyff in the NASL in LA. You know, clearly got on with him very well, and insists that he comes to Ajax as a 36-year-old to play as a sweeper. You know, it's just that, you know, it's Stanley Brad for Feyenoord, a left back that he insists plays as a almost as a left winger. He pushes him that high up the pitch in a bid to stop the opposing right back bombing forward, so Cruyff doesn't have to do the legwork in keeping up with the, you know, a marauding right back. It's you know, that fine line between genius and insanity that is clearly there. You know, in effect, you know, those years at Ajax and Feyenoord between late 81, he signs back on the dotted line at Ajax, to him hanging up his boots at the end of the 83-84 season. These, what, 2.5 years where he's effectively player manager, you know, despite, you know, the far from insignificant, you know, presence as coach at Ajax of Beenhakker, you know, who would, you know, eventually manage Real Madrid. He'd take the Netherlands to a World Cup, you know, a dysfunctional World Cup, but a World Cup all the same. So, you know, it's that force of personality and that, you know, we go back round the block again to that arrogance, you know, that we spoke of at the start, that it just permeates throughout the entirety of his career. But it's very, very pronounced. It's even more pronounced during those final years as a player.
It's interesting, well, you know, I mean, hearing Steve talk about this, you couldn't get a better example of the old phrase, that form's fleeting and class is forever. I was, in my Ajax book, I managed to get an interview with a guy called Sonny Saloy, who was at Ajax when Cruyff came back as young players coming through. And he said he couldn't believe, I mean, Sonny Saloy went to play to international football for the Orange as well. And he said, I couldn't believe any footballer could be this talented. And this is a guy who is 7, 8, 9 years past his peak. And what a player, he said, what a player he must have been at his peak. And but he learned, since he learned so much. And he did not only, Steve talked about the player manager on the park. He said he was directing everything, organising, go there, this pass is going to come to you, move there, go, you go forward, you go back. The talent of the guy, even, you know, as I say, as Steve said, in his latter years was, you know, Sonny Saloy could speak volumes of his talent, about his talent.
I mean, this leads us in very nicely to the bit I've written about him coming back to Ajax as a coach. Because obviously, you know, we talk there of, as a player, the coaching he's doing, if you like, on the field. And this, well, I guess this has been something that's been with him throughout to some extent, hasn't it? But it became even more so in those later years with Ajax and Feyenoord. You know, I struggle to think of a player who was more suited to becoming a manager than Cruyff. I can't really think of anyone else who's practically been doing it all the time anyway. Perhaps, I guess, his protege Guardiola is another example. But Cruyff, I think, is another level. As I say, being a de facto coach on the field, the voice, the eyes, or I guess the mind of the coach on the field, in the middle of it all, the deep understanding, obviously, of the tactical side of things, appreciation of space, as we talked about earlier, like David Winner talks about in that book, you know, the movement, all this seems to have been setting him on the path to one day become a coach and be able to shape a team, and beyond that, an entire club from top to bottom with his philosophy. As with this playing, you know, Ajax just seemed right for it, didn't it? You know, he buried the hatchet, or they both buried the hatchet a little bit from his second controversial departure from Ajax as a player. And, you know, he saw it that he'd taken his revenge on them on the field. by winning the double with Feyenoord. You know, he dealt with that situation there, and they were happy to have him back. They approached him, as did Feyenoord, about becoming a coach. But, you know, because Ajax wanted him to become a coach, that's where he wanted to be. They did actually have to create a new role for him, technical director or some such title, because he didn't have coaching qualifications. And you needed to have coaching qualifications, kind of like your modern day UEFA pro license or whatever it is that you need. He didn't have any of this. He then, of course, being Cruyff, got into a row with the KNVB about this, of, you know, there should be some sort of fast track for players who've played at the highest level to just give them their badge, because, you know, I've got the understanding of everything. But he lost that argument initially, and it took a few years to work out. But, you know, they had to invent a new role for him so he could become their manager. Every now and then he had to sort of pretend he wasn't, I think, whenever the KNVB came by. But, you know, he got the opportunity to imprint his whole philosophy on the club. And like I say, it was from top to bottom. So it wasn't just for him about the first team and results, though obviously being the manager, the results did come into it. But, you know, for him, it was more about developing the player, developing their education, understanding about, also about entertaining, about having fun, about the appreciation of space, the fluid on-field adjustments and all of that, dominating through possession. And the results came as a result of all of that. It wasn't the prime focus. His time at Ajax, and we've already mentioned a little bit about some of the people coming through when he was a player, Stephen was talking about there, but his time as a coach, some of those were coming slightly more into their prime, the likes of Van Basten and Vandenberg and so on. There was also Frank Rijkaard, of course, at the club at the time. There was the experience of Arnold Muren, a colleague from Cruyff's first spell as a player there, so he was schooled in that way. Ronald Koeman joined Ajax as Cruyff had left in the early 80s as a player. But he was there when he was there, came back as a coach. There was Aaron Winter, John Van Schip, Robin, Richard Vitschke, John Bosman, Ronald De Boer, Brian Roar. The list goes on and on. And then, of course, there was the emergence of Dennis Bergkamp as well. And I think with him, you can see a lot of parallels, I think, in terms of style of player. Certainly not in character, it doesn't seem that way. But in terms of style as a player, I see quite a lot of similarities in this sort of appreciation of space. And, you know, Bergkamp instinctively lobs a goalkeeper because just to him, that's the most logical way of getting the ball into the net. And that's the kind of sort of vision and thinking that Cruyff would have appreciated and instilled, I think. Under Cruyff, though, at Ajax, for all Van Basten's goals, and my God, there were loads and loads and loads of them, they couldn't topple the strong PSV side in the Eredivisie at that time. This was PSV at their finest, of course, winning the European Cup in this spell. But Ajax did win the Dutch Cup twice and the European Cup Winners' Cup as well. They reached the final of another one, but Cruyff was gone by then. More on that in a sec. Trouble lay ahead, though. Yes, Ajax's unwillingness. It was all about money, finance and contracts and all this kind of thing. There's always some sort of squabble going on, as the guys have said. There's always something happening with all these strong characters clashing. Ajax as a club at that time were unwilling to sort of go the extra mile in terms of transfers, both incoming and outgoing. So they wouldn't pay them, but they also wouldn't demand them as well to such extent. As a result, they lost the likes of Vandenberg and Koeman to PSV. You know, they did replace them with Jan Wouters and Danny Blind, but it's not quite the same. They lost Van Basten to Milan, of course. Now, this one stung Cruyff particularly, not just because he lost a great player. You know, I think Cruyff was clear enough to see that stepping up to Milan was something that Van Basten was good enough for, and that was probably going to happen regardless. But the fact that he was let go by Ajax for a fraction of the cost that PSV received from Milan in the same summer for Ruud Gullit really, really stung. And this led to various rows, of course, as you can imagine. Cruyff and Rijkaard then had a massive falling out. When Cruyff pushed Rijkaard into more of a leadership role than he was comfortable with. He was slightly more reserved character than Van Basten. This was to compensate for the loss of Van Basten. You know, a strong leader in the team, he saw Rijkaard as that. Rijkaard didn't quite see it that way, and he got drawn into all these arguments with the board. And it ultimately led to his departure. But 3 years, or nearly 3 years, he was there. In that time, for all these issues that were always bubbling away and eventually exploded, as would always be the way, the club had been transformed, like I say, from top to bottom. All the teams at all the level would play the same way, the way he wanted them to to learn, to practice, to be skilled at, so that everybody coming through would know what the system was, would know what their roles were, would know what everyone else's role were for all the interchange that was required. You know, his vision was to implement the Dutch football of the 70s that he had grown up with. He perfected, if you like, at that time as a player. He'd seen Dutch footballers drifting away from that a little bit while he'd been elsewhere, and he wanted to bring it back to what he knew and what he wanted to do best. And he wanted to implement all of this at Ajax. And he did in such a short time from top to bottom. And you can see, though, that though he left, and obviously he went on to Barcelona and did exactly the same there, and with even greater success, of course, the imprint he left on Ajax, the sort of foundations, I guess, for what they did. So everything that was achieved with Van Gaal in the 1990s, and then even much more recently, you know, the success of recent generations and the players that have come through again there in recent years from the team that got to the Champions League semi-final a few years ago. Lots of those players have gone on elsewhere and done hugely well. This imprint is all part of the DNA that he re-stamped, I guess, if you like, back on Ajax. He'd been there when it had been sort of imprinted the first time, and he placed it back on again and took it to extremes because he was then in charge. So that has now infused the club so utterly. And again, we talk about people with influence and people who've caused influence on club. I guess as a manager, he did exactly the same with Barcelona as well, in terms of how deeply he's influenced the club for years and years after he'd gone. And that is quite a remarkable thing, I think, for the huge generations that have followed still revere what he did in a shorter spell of time, but still do things the same way because the club has been utterly altered by him. So, yeah, obviously he moved on to Barcelona and I guess perhaps had even greater impact there, the dream team and all of that kind of thing. I mean, Stephen, reflecting on him as a coach, Ajax and Barcelona, I guess Barcelona was the one where he had the most incredible team there, and the delights that team had at its disposal. But again, the imprint and the DNA that he's infused into that club, it's still visible now, isn't it?
Oh, completely. Everything that Barcelona did, I think that someone pointed out that no one at Barcelona as a coach tends to succeed if they move away from the scriptures of Cruyff, you know, and the blueprint that he put down for the club to prosper with and to follow from future generations. Now, some coaches have tried to make a break from it, but they don't tend to last long. It tends to be someone else who comes in with the, you know, the Cruyff way of thinking. So yes, you know, it's stunning just how much of a legacy he's left at Barcelona and Ajax as well. You know, because Ajax keep on coming back to it. You know, Van Gaal's Ajax of the 1990s was, you know, a take on total football. It was a speeded up version of it. It was a little bit more in your face as such, but it was still unmistakably grounded within the same principles. And you know, the contemporary Ajax have gone back to that again. So yeah, you know, it's a very unique thing. It's a very unique situation.
I mean, Paul, can you think of anyone else who's influenced two big clubs in such a way, or maybe not to this extent, but you know, impact in more than one place? There's so many people have had a huge impact on one club, not perhaps to this degree, but huge impact. But to do it on two?
Well, I think that makes quite a unique achievement, doesn't it, Aidan? I mean, you're probably having to go back a little bit, you know, in terms of football history. I mean, you could make a case of saying that Brian Clough left a huge influence on both Derby County and Nottingham Forest, but that it's going back quite a bit. I accept that. Yeah, I mean, it's you know, listen to what you and Stephen are both saying there about the legacy Cruyff left at both Ajax and Barcelona. It's, you know, I think I don't think he would be given that opportunity if he was a manager now, because I think now the game's changed more in terms of a short-term success rather than long-term vision. And I'm not quite sure directors would have the paces now to give someone that amount of control over every aspect of the club. So, you know, the style of management that Cruyff brought into both Ajax and Barcelona, the DNA, which you referenced there, that he left on both clubs, I don't think any individual would be allowed that level of power anymore. And when you think, you know, what the structures are within clubs these days, you know, we've all different coaches, specialist coaches, advisors, head of recruitment, all this sort of package. I just don't think anyone would allow an individual that level of free reign to make their own decisions. I mean, to an extent, Bielsa tried at Leeds, didn't he? He tried to impose his own kind of system. He wants all the teams playing the same way. When you watched the Bielsa team, you knew it was a Bielsa team. You didn't have to know which teams were... You know, the team could not warn a club crash. You wouldn't know straight away it was a Bielsa team. And I just think the style that Johan Cruyff introduced would not be allowed by clubs. They wouldn't want the face to be so entwined by the philosophy and vision of one player. And to me, football is so much supporter for that, because you know what has been Cruyff's legacy in terms of football is A, not just his legacy as a player, but B, it's a fascinating debate, this. Did Cruyff leave more of a legacy as a player or as a coach? Discuss.
Gary, answer that.
It's interesting, you know, I mean, the idea of all the teams as a club, you know, the youth teams, the under 16s, 15s, wasn't down to Cruyff originally. It wasn't down to Mikkels. It wasn't down to Buckingham. It was actually created at Ajax by a guy called Jack Reynolds, Uncle Jack, as they call him in Amsterdam, who actually, when he took over at Ajax, created that philosophy. And it was picked up by Buckingham and then Mikkels and then Cruyff. And Cruyff took it to Barcelona and La Masia, the players coming through from the youth academy there, Barcelona, are all schooled in the way that Cruyff said Barcelona should play, as is the first team to this day. And if you're asking me the question, is Cruyff more influential as a player or a coach? I think you have to say his sort of legacy looking forward now, the way the football is played now, very much as a coach.
Okay, well, final few questions then before we finish. Otherwise, we will literally be here all night talking about Cruyff, Ajax, the Dutch and so on. Short, snappy answers on this one, please. So, Stephen, first one for you. Where did Cruyff have the biggest influence?
Cruyff had the biggest influence at Ajax. I think.
Oh, I see what he did there. You can get several eras in one go.
I think the first time, if I've got to be specific, the first time around at Ajax, because he helped turn this club that was part of a part-time football setup and turned them into the Kings of Europe. You know, Barcelona, a football club of significance before Cruyff. You know, they've been a club of significance since Cruyff. You know, there would have been a significant Barcelona without Cruyff, whether he'd been there or not. You know, he helped, you know, create a variant of Barcelona, a variant of an already great football club. And while Ajax were a storied football club before Cruyff, you know, there is a before Cruyff when it comes to Ajax. You know, he along with Mikkels turned them into the best team on the face of the planet, you know, for those 3 years in the early 1970s. And I think that's the difference there. You know, he did great things wherever he went, but I don't know, that what he did in the 60s and the 70s, the early 70s with Ajax is, I think the pinnacle.
All right, brilliant. Okay, Gary, for you, where does Cruyff the player sit amongst the greatest ever to play the game?
Right at the top. There might be people equal. I mean, you can argue who surpasses him, but short, sharp answer, right at the top.
Oh, very good, very good. Okay, Paul, then, where does Cruyff the manager sit?
That's a far more interesting debate, that one, I'd say. He's certainly in terms of the legacy that he's left, I'd say you could make a case for being in the top three. To achieve success as a lower ranking in terms of status European football nation in Ajax as a manager, and then to achieve at Barcelona, it's quite some feat, because it's quite a change of mindset, expectations, things like that. So I'd put him in the top three. And if you're going to ask me who's a better manager than him, then you need to give me a bit more time to think about that.
Well, Howard Kendall is the obvious answer there, Paul, isn't it?
I was thinking Steve Bruce, but I wasn't quite sure.
Oh, don't start that again. Very good, very good. And finally, the usual question we round off with is, apart from your own article, once you've flicked through, had a look at the great artwork that goes alongside it and had a scan through the rest, what will you be heading for first, Stephen?
It's like shooting fish in the barrel, this one. You know, there's so much.
Yes.
You know, I think with this, it's, I think it's just a case of flipping the through the page of the magazine and just stopping whatever you can. But no, I think certainly in honour of what will be a momentous magazine for these Football Times, because, you know, this is the last stand of Gary Thacker, where it comes to the magazine, you know, which should make this the most valuable, you know, copy of these Football Times ever made. You know, he will be remaining with us in terms of the podcast, but yeah, this is so in a way, this is kind of like one of the books stag dudes, you know, in so many respects. I will be going to the works of Gary first on this one.
Oh, what an answer. There you go, Gary. Absolutely spot on. Brilliant answer. Well, Gary, you can't say either of those, though, can you? So what's your answer?
Well, first I say, God bless you, Stephen. Thank you, my boy. I think probably I would go to Chris's piece on as Barcelona manager, because I think the influence he had on football comes primarily from his time at Barcelona, and probably more as a manager than as a player. The dream team, and how it fell apart. You couldn't get much more Cruyffian than the thing that you love the most, you decide to destroy. Couldn't get more Cruyffian than that.
Absolutely. And how about you, Paul?
Well, I mean, I totally echo what Stephen said there about Gary. I think the first articles I'll go to will be to Gary's two articles, because he's such a fabulous, talented writer. He's got such a passion for Cruyff and for Holland. So he's the go-to guy for this sort of thing. Absolutely. But seeing Stephen's beat me to that, I think from the options there, I mean, I would definitely be interested in the US experience that Josh has written about, because that's an era of Cruyff's career I'm not totally familiar with. I'd just like to get more of a bit of a background insight into how that worked out. So, I mean, you mentioned before, Steve, about Cruyff playing the ASL. I've completely forgotten about that. So this whole American experience, we, you know, is something I'd like to explore further.
Fantastic. Yes, well, that is one of many articles that are in there, which will sure make absolutely fabulous reading. But this is, I guess, the final call, final warning, if you like, the Cruyff magazine, or the Gary Thacker tribute special, if you like. That is out now, 1st of November. Will soon sell out, so you can be sure of that. So if this is your thing, and if you've listened this far, I'm quite sure that it is, then get your order in. It will be an absolute beauty, filled with great art, great writing, great stories. Two pieces from Gary Thacker as his parting shot. As Cruyff himself once said, quality without results is pointless. Results without quality is boring. Well, this magazine has both of those. I can assure you of that. So thanks, guys, for all your contributions to the pod. Cheers, Stephen.
Cheers, Aidan. It's been a joy as always.
And Paul, thanks very much.
Yeah, thanks for hosting, Aidan. Thanks for giving us all the chance to speak. And thanks to Stephen and Gary for their wonderful insights and their impeccable knowledge of all things Cruyff in Dutch football. It's been an absolute education to be in these guys' company tonight.
Oh, you too, Paul.
A couple of those thoughts.
Right back at you.
Absolutely. And cheers, Gary.
Yeah, thanks, buddy. You can't beat sort of signing off talking about Dutch football, Ajax and Cruyff. Wonderful. Cheers, guys.
Yes, this entire magazine was set up in honour of Gary's departure from the magazine writing, just to make sure it was the perfect theme, and I think we found it. And thanks everyone for listening as well. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have, and please do join us again on the Lob podcast from These Football Times. Thank you and bye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.